You are listening to CEO Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.
Welcome to this episode of CEO Perspectives, a signature series by the Conference Board. CEO Perspectives are conversations that take an objective, nonpartisan look at a range of timely topics that matter most to business leaders. To help make sense of these topics and how they'll unfold, we'll sit down with thought leaders and do what we do best at the Conference Board, provide trusted insights for what's ahead. I'm Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board and the host of this podcast series. In today's conversation, we're going to talk about what's going on in Russia and Ukraine. Recently, President Vladimir Putin announced a partial mobilization of 300,000 troops to fight in Ukraine and referendums in the four occupied regions in Ukraine. There's a lot going on. Joining me today is Dr. Lori Esposito Murray. Lori is the president of the Committee for Economic Development, which is the public policy center of the Conference Board. But more importantly, Lori is a recognized global expert in geopolitics. Lori, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. It's a privilege to be here today to talk about this really critical global issue that has tremendous impact for the economy, for human rights, for possibly expanded war. So thank you.
Yeah, no, and it's a really scary time. So just give us briefly the background. When did this all start? You know, what has happened and where are we?
So we're 7 months in. This started in February. And this is a particularly important inflection point in the war. But to step back, it's in order to understand where we are now, it's important to remember that before Putin actually invaded, just hours before he invaded, he announced and recognized the independence of the republics in the Donbass region. And that we're going to fast forward to where we are today in just a minute. But their independence actually was the reason for the war. He went in to protect them, rolls into Ukraine with 100,000 plus troops that had been stationed on the border. And it's a disaster. He had expected to just march into Kyiv and remove the government, put in a Russian government. And what the world saw was a disastrous curtain rising on a Russian military that had been upgrading itself for over a decade and displaying that it couldn't do combined arms operations. It couldn't do resupply. The morale was low. And he thought, and the military thought they'd go in, and he was told by his military they'd go in and be received by flowers. He's met with the Ukraine response, unanticipated from President Zelensky, as opposed to fleeing. He stays, the Ukrainians fight. And this war was a real problem for him. He changes leadership, tries to change strategy. And he's now looking for that land bridge that actually connects Crimea to these upper northern northeastern regions. He does fine. Their new strategy is working. It looks like it's a march to Odessa. And then NATO and the US and its allies, after having imposed very severe sanctions and providing military aid to Ukraine, actually step up their military aid with more sophisticated weapons. And we see this play out again, where the Russians are withdrawing from areas that they had taken over chaotically. They're running away is what we have seen. And right. So this is a particular inflection point, and we have Putin then turning to political weapons and the use of political weapons, which involves the votes that you were just talking about, the referendums, right, and unconventional use of military assets in terms of the pipelines attacks that we all, you know, that is pretty much assumed that it was Russia that did these attacks on the gas pipelines, Nord Stream 1 and 2.
Okay, so you covered a lot there. Let's dial this back a little bit. So Crimea is the peninsula. It's on the Black Sea. It's where the ports are. And, you know, Russia has been occupying that for some time. So the four regions that you're talking about are the Donbas region, which are in the Far East. And there were Russian-speaking people there. And so President Putin, you know, nominally said that he was going in to protect those Russian speakers, but those Russian speakers were largely imported, so or exported from Russia, imported into Ukraine. So talk a little bit about the Donbas and why this region is so volatile.
So it's absolutely critical because it is part of Putin's storytelling to the Russian people as to, first of all, you know, step back. Putin announces in August very publicly to his military in a letter to his military and publicly announces that Ukraine is really part of Russia. So that was August of 2021, which really starts the ball rolling here. And part of that is the fact that this Donbass region, which had been a part of the 2014 problem after the annexation of Crimea, this Donbass region had really been under the control of Russian surrogates since 2014. He declares their independence. He recognizes their independence before he, and that's the basis for the war in order to come in. And then obviously the goal being to remove the Ukrainian government. But that's his entry in. So that's a very important area for him. It has been under Russian surrogates. And now he's claiming that these sham referendums with 90%, 87% of the vote, that they are actually, and Putin's about to have a big public red square celebration that the Donbass, along with the two southern areas that they control, are about to become part of Russia, which is very, very significant.
Right. But recently, the Russian troops actually retreated from the Donbas region back to the Russian border. Why did they do that if they were going to announce this referendum and annex it?
I think the answers are very simple and a very straightforward one. They couldn't hold the territory. It was interesting what Ukraine was doing. They were fighting in the south and decided that they really needed to, as opposed to these defensive strategies, really needed to have a more aggressive strategy to keep the Russians off kilter and started an offensive in the Donbas region. And the Russian military couldn't hold it. The Russian soldiers chaotically left. It was really clear once the Ukrainians went in that this was an area that was not left. The Russians said they were pulling back to resupply. The chaos of the weapon systems left behind and the destruction of systems so that they couldn't be used by the Ukrainian forces, the mess that the Russian soldiers left in order to be able to flee was really clear once the Ukrainians moved in.
Okay, but so now he's going to announce the sham vote happened and that they voted to join Russia and he's going to annex these regions, do this big celebration. But how is he going to hold it? I mean, they had to retreat because they couldn't hold it. How does this work after this?
Okay, so that gets to the point you raised at the very beginning, which is that he has called for partial mobilization of 300,000 Russian reservists, so to speak, although that's not how it's quite rolling out. But if you've had military experience, you are supposed to be in that 300,000. Again, chaos seems to be reigning here. First of all, that mobilization is not taking place in cities because Putin doesn't want to deal with the disruption within the major cities. He's doing it out in the farther regions. He's also apparently mobilizing ethnic troops or ethnic reservists and also ethnic population that haven't had military experience. But the plan, though, is that the 300,000 additional troops, after they have lost 80,000, the 300,000 mobilization will provide what is needed for these new areas that are now part of Russia, the Donbass and the two southern areas.
Okay, so there have been a couple of quotes from very senior Russian people recently. First of all, their foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, said NATO is, in essence, engaged in a war with Russia through a proxy that is arming and that is arming that proxy. Everyone is reciting incantations that in no case can we allow World War III. This is dangerous. This is serious. We must not underestimate it. And then Sergei Kiryenko, who is the first deputy chief of the Russian presidential staff, says that Russia is engaged in a war with NATO, not with Ukraine, but with NATO. He says, we understand very well that on the territory of Ukraine, we are not at war with Ukraine, and of course, not at war with Ukrainians. The entire NATO bloc is fighting a war against Russia. This is regarding the territory of Ukraine. So they're implying here that there's no war in Ukraine. You know, don't look here. It's essentially NATO has attacked Russia through Ukraine. Why are they making these statements? And, you know, peel back, what are they really saying?
So there are two very important points here and two very important audiences that those comments are addressing. One is internal. They have to, if you're mobilizing 300,000 reservists, and I put that in quotes, reservists, you have to have a reason to mobilize the Russian people to support this war. And in terms of public opinion, and clearly they're failing because of the protests that are going on around the country. But in order to understand those statements, it's rallying the Russian people to understand that, or to make them believe that this is a much larger attack on the sovereignty of Russia by NATO, the US. It's not just about Ukraine. And so it's a way of rousing public opinion in his favor, in Putin's favor. The other audience, of course, is NATO, the US allies and partners, you know, half of the world's GDP, who are supporting the sanctions, who are very loudly against what Putin is doing in Ukraine, and particularly this annexation now that's happening and this latest egregious step. He's addressing them in a deterrent way. This is part of his playbook in Ukraine. He started the war announcing that he was recognizing the independence of these regions going in. And by the way, he told the West, and particularly the US and NATO, I'm putting my nuclear forces on alert. And so this is his deterrence playbook to keep US, NATO from responding the way we need to respond to the egregious measures he's taking to make them reconsider what type of aid, what type of response, because it's now a tripwire. He set up a tripwire, and you have to take him seriously, and you have to take the Russian leadership seriously, that this is a threat that they're imposing. And it has more seriousness now because he is about to announce the annexation of these territories.
And right, but Lori, you know, as you sit here in the West and you look at this, on one hand, people say, well, this is just Russian rhetoric, you know, and, you know, of course he has to say this to keep his people in line and, you know, motivated. But at what point does this trigger something real?
So unfortunately for the world, it's up to Putin to decide when it triggers something real. And that's why it's so dangerous. As he gets more trapped, I mean, clearly what's happening with this mobilization is showing again the world that he has very, very serious problems with not only his military, but with the strategy in Ukraine, and he can't afford to fail. And so he sets up this nuclear tripwire. And so you have to take it seriously. So far, most of the systems along the missile systems, along the tactical systems, along the Ukrainian border or close to the Ukrainian border that could actually implement this nuclear attack are dual capable. And so far, according to reports, our intelligence, and also actually according to our high level US officials, they haven't seen any activity to indicate that they're preparing those systems to be nuclear systems. But nonetheless, he has his finger on the button. It is Putin's decision if he is going to allow that tripwire to happen. And so we have to be prepared. And this is the role of the NSC to prepare options. Reportedly, the NSC has reported options. And according to Jake Sullivan, a national security advisor, they have actually very explicitly told the Russians how we would respond.
We're talking with Dr. Lori Esposito Murray about the explosive events happening in Russia and Ukraine. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
As you and your company monitor the volatile and uncertain economy, the award-winning forecast team at the Conference Board predicts a downturn by the end of 2022. Recession will further compound the crises that have recently upended expectations, from a deadly pandemic to a war in Ukraine and the highest inflation in decades.
Yet, unprecedented crises also present unforeseen opportunities if you have a trusted, proven navigator by your side. With that in mind, and as the Conference Board has always done, we are providing you with daily, timely, and relevant content that will guide the business community through the economic storm. These trusted insights are being gathered on our website and are available to help your company master the challenges. To find out how you can chart a course for the future which will allow your business to emerge stronger on the other side, visit our free economic hub entitled Navigating the Economic Storm, Your Indispensable Guide Through the Global Recession, located at conference-board.org/topics/recession.
Welcome back to CEO Perspectives. I'm your host, Steve Odlin, the CEO of the Conference Board, and I'm joined today by Dr. Lori Esposito-Murray, the president of the Committee for Economic Development and a globally recognized expert in geopolitics. So, Lori, you know, this nuclear question that you were talking about before the break is deeply disturbing. Andrei Gurilov, the State Duma deputy and former deputy commander of Russia's Southern Military District, said that NATO is involved in a nuclear arms race, which could lead to a potential nuclear conflict. Also, iodine pills are selling out in Europe. I mean, there are people taking this extremely seriously. What are the odds here of some form of nuclear conflict?
So the odds are probably higher than they ever have been in the post-Soviet era. So since the Soviet Union collapsed, the odds are the highest they ever have been. They're even higher than they were in February. The central piece of this that is critical and related to this annexation is that Russian nuclear policy is that it is based on the fact, one of the reasons of the four that they would be that they would use nuclear weapons is if their territory is attacked, under attack. When Putin announces the annexation of the Donbas region and the two southern areas, they become Russian territory.
In their minds, of course.
Yeah. And so the messaging that's happening on nuclear weapons is deliberately linked to this annexation. So in order to make it very clear and deter any response or to soften the response to the annexation. What's interesting is, you know, we're hearing a lot that, and it is the playbook for Crimea in terms of annexation, the sham referendum. But what is very different from the playbook that Putin is using for Crimea is this added nuclear component, this nuclear threat that he's now added. So this is a little bit different than the Crimea playbook in a very, very important way in terms of what he's added as a component to that strategy.
Yeah, but this is really serious. I mean, when you and I were kids in school, we used to do the nuclear drills where, you know, they would have us get under our desk, you know, which I'm not sure what that would have solved, but you know, they weren't tornado drills, they were nuclear drills. I mean, this was real back in the 50s and the 60s, but here we are again. What kind of nuclear weapons could be deployed here? I mean, what is he thinking about?
So it's hard to know. He has a whole range of nuclear weapons. And, you know, to put this in context, we have gone from, you know, the good news is, as a global community, we have gone from 70,000 nuclear weapons in 1986, which was the peak, to about 13,000 worldwide. And 90% of those are US-Russia. Of those, Russia has 4,000 nuclear weapons in its stockpile. It has about 2,000 tactical nuclear weapons. And then, of course, it has the missiles platforms that are close to the border of Ukraine, which are the ones that we watch all of these, but you could, you know, particularly watch very closely to see what's happening. He has a range of options. And for the United States and for NATO, it is part of the policy process to consider all those different options, from a nuclear demonstration of one nuclear weapon to the use of one tactical nuclear weapon to these several tactical nuclear weapons. You know, what strategy he uses, in any case, whatever happens, is puts us in, if he decides to use nuclear weapons, and although on a probability scale, you would hope that probability is on the lower end of the scale. But, you know, as I've been saying, it's his decision. We should get some warning, but you don't get very much warning if it's depending on the type of system he uses. But if he decides to do that tripwire, this is really dangerous. It could easily escalate even if it's a demonstration nuclear weapon. It just puts the whole world in a position that it has never been in since probably the Cuban Missile Crisis.
But I don't hear you saying that, you've got 4,000 nuclear weapons, half of them are battlefield tactical weapons, the other ones are ballistic missiles. I don't hear you saying that he's going to press a button and launch all his ballistic missiles at North America. What I hear you saying is that it's probably more likely that if he does something, it will be on a battlefield level, some sort of dirty bomb, limited. But even that is huge because it impacts water, crops, it impacts people. And then it puts the West in a position of having to do something, right?
Right. And just to clarify, it's 4,000 strategic weapons plus the 2,000 tactical.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Yes, it does. And look at what happened with the nuclear energy facility, the plant Chernobyl. The extreme damage there. Which also raises, there are a number of options here in terms of how Putin can actually use the nuclear threat, although he clearly is talking about using nuclear weapons. We have seen him, the war started with Russian troops taking over Chernobyl and talking about the long-term damage that happens with a nuclear energy plant basically melting down. They had to remove those troops because they had radiation poisoning. So this is, that happened in the 80s, just to show you the long-term problems that happen. And he's also right now shelling the largest European nuclear energy facility in Ukraine. And so there are a couple of nuclear options here, but what he's done is to actually ratchet up the threat of using nuclear weapons.
Well, okay, but as you said, the threat is higher than it's ever been before. Is it rhetoric? Is it not rhetoric? So let's say that, he finally crosses the line and uses some sort of battlefield nuclear weapon. What response will happen? What must the West do at that point?
Well, what's interesting is that we have, according to Jake Sullivan, we have clearly shared with the Russians what he has called catastrophic consequences, and the president has actually addressed this as well. Catastrophic consequences would be from the use of a nuclear weapon.
And what do you think that? What do you think that? What do you think that plan is that they've shared?
Well, the whole role of the NSC is to present the president options. And so they have been running through these tabletop exercises reportedly, and they should be running through tabletop exercises in terms of the various options that the Russians may use, and to have responses for each of those. Catastrophic consequences, if you want my interpretation of that, goes beyond severe sanctions, and actually sounds like it's the consequences will be really severe with, going all the way down the spectrum in terms of options. How do you respond militarily? Does that engage the U.S. and NATO in the war? Do you respond with nuclear weapons? These are all options on the table.
Right. But you pointed out, and it's been publicized, that there has been communicated what the catastrophic option is. Is that a tit-for-tat nuclear response on the part of the United States or NATO?
It has to include that option. It has to include you. If you're giving the president a range of options, you have to include that option in your consideration. What's interesting about making sure that the Russians know what the consequences would be clearly is actually a result of how we started this war. There were arguments, you may remember in the beginning, whether we should not just talk about sanctions coming after an action by the Russians, but that we should be telling them in advance exactly what we would do. And we should actually be imposing some of those sanctions even before they did. That was the big debate. The lessons learned from this war, we've seen it play out in Taiwan. The president has very explicitly now said, warned the Chinese that we would use military force. And in this case, back to Ukraine, very clearly saying there would be catastrophic consequences publicly, and then actually sharing those consequences with Russia.
Okay, but so Russia uses a battlefield nuke somewhere in Ukrainian territory, you know, somewhere there. The West then uses a nuclear weapon back, theoretically the same size scale. Where? Red Square?
So, you know, what's interesting about this, Stephen, the most dangerous part of all of it is that once a nuclear weapon is used, if Putin trips that wire, and he knows this, I mean, once it is used, it is very, very hard to control escalation. Now, Russian nuclear policy says you use a nuclear weapon to de-escalate, you know, escalate to de-escalate, that the reaction would be if a nuclear weapon is used, with the world, the opposition, NATO, US would then de-escalate and say, okay, let's find a solution to this problem before we escalate to war. That's a very, very dangerous assumption, and probably not how this would play out. There have been tabletop exercises done by RAND Corporation and other major defense think tanks that it is just a very short period of time. It is a matter of hours before this escalates into a major nuclear war.
All right. That's really frightening. But you also mentioned early on that the Nord Stream pipeline now has been sabotaged. It's presumably by Russia. You know, it's hard to understand where they're going here. I mean, this seems to be driven by one man and, you know, some people around him. Clearly, there have been thousands of protesters thrown in jail. You have, you know, those 300,000 potential conscripts are rushing for the border. They're trying to get out. I mean, he doesn't have the complete support. I mean, there are, you know, clearly supporters in this, and there's enough around him to that he's been, you know, stayed in power. What's the off ramp here? I mean, you know, where does it go from here?
What's interesting about what's happening to the leaks coming from the Nord Stream 1 and the Nord Stream 2 pipelines is that, again, this is it's more than signaling, because it's actual attacks that have happened. And so far, it has not been attributed to Russia. It's very hard. And Russia has actually been saying it's the U.S. That has done this to make it
which
look
is like how you know it's actually them. So
right. To ask, yeah. So that
historically.
Yeah. And back to your point about them saying this is a war with NATO and the U.S. This is, oh, the U.S. is doing this because they, you know, they want to escalate this war. But it is pretty clear that it is completely in Russian interest to do this. It's an important signaling. It's an important signaling of the use of other unconventional means. So you have the unconventional means of using the annexation, and you have in order to achieve the strategic goals in Ukraine. This is signaling in terms of the military that they're going to do, they're capable of asymmetric responses, and they're thinking in terms of asymmetric responses militarily.
And so, what else could that include?
The signal that's coming from here is, well, in terms of affecting the actual supply of gas, you know, as you know, Nord Stream 1 was shut down in August, and Nord Stream 2 was never operated. So it's not actually affecting gas supply. What it is signaling that the gas pipelines that Norway is now offering to supply the Europeans as much as possible through their gas supply, those are vulnerable. It's signaling that there are about 300 cables that connect the internet globally. Those are undersea. Those are all vulnerable. There are many ways you can have an asymmetric response. There's asymmetric response, including cyber attacks. And so he's signaling that if you respond to our annexation, which is actually Putin's way of perhaps even solving his public relations problems in Russia, his positioning in Russia, both with the right as well as with the Russian population in terms of their attitudes towards the war. You know, he's signaling that if you respond, he's got the nuclear weapons on the table very explicitly, and he also has this asymmetrical response that he can attack energy systems, connectivity systems that really keep the world, the U.S. and the world functioning.
So is the conclusion here that it's you know, that the Donbass is lost, that Crimea is permanently part of Russia, that this is this is it, and Russia will have this territory, and you know, then we all go forward, and you know, everything will be fine unless somebody crosses the line. I mean, does Ukraine just stand down and say, okay, we give up, and you can have it, and you know, life goes on, or you know, is this headed for something far more serious?
I think you just laid out what Putin's objectives are. I mean, that's what I believe that he is hoping to get out of this. That one, he salvages Russia's reputation within Russia, you know, his ruling of Russia within Russia, by saying, well, in June, he mentioned that the most important areas, he kind of pulled back in terms of his rhetoric about the importance of the Donbas region being really one of the main strategic objectives of this war. So that was in June. So he's achieving that goal. He's having a big Red Square rally around it and more, because he's getting that land bridge to Crimea. So he can announce victory, but victory is only a victory if the US, NATO, our allies and partners, and especially Ukraine, see it the same way. And the Ukrainians and President Zelensky, I think this will only motivate them even more in terms of this illegal annexation of their territory. And as a matter of fact, President Zelensky has said, if they annex these four regional areas, announce an annexation of these four regional areas, that that takes diplomacy off the table. It makes it impossible to have a diplomatic solution. So as far as the president has been really clear in terms of, and NATO has been really clear in terms of this being an illegal annexation, not going to be recognized. And we have an aid package, another aid package in the continuing resolution that we're planning on delivering. And so, and NATO has said that they will not falter in their support of Ukraine. So I don't think we're going to get the outcome that Putin wants or is expecting.
All right. Lori, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Steve. Really appreciate the invitation.
And thanks to all of you for listening into CEO Perspectives. Every week, I'll be joined by an expert in their field to provide insights on the issues of our time. We'll talk about geopolitics, economics, human capital, ESG, and more. Please do share CEO Perspectives with your colleagues and with your friends. I know that they'll want to listen too. I'm Steve Odland, and this podcast has been brought to you by the Conference Board.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Conference Board, the indispensable ally that has helped businesses through war, recession, and economic transformation for over 100 years. As recent unexpected economic challenges persist, you can chart a course for the future, which will allow your business to emerge stronger on the other side. Just visit our free economic hub entitled Navigating the Economic Storm, Your Indispensable Guide Through the Global Recession, located at www.conference-board.org/topics/recession.